Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Well, within the urban landscape of Sacramento is a crown jewel, the American River Parkway. It runs from downtown Sacramento to Folsom Lake, and millions of visitors take advantage of the parkway each year. Whether paddleboarding, rafting, fishing, cycling, running, or just plain sitting and taking in nature, the parkway reminds us of the wildlife and the beauty in our backyard. But there is a growing concern about the well-being of the American River Parkway. From hazardous waste to contaminated water, encampments along the river, not to mention the increased fire risk. There have already been multiple grass fires so far this year. We're going to be joined by the City of Sacramento Fire Department in just a moment. But first, we're going to bring in Diana Poggetto. She is the executive director of the American River Parkway Foundation, which is devoted to protecting 23 miles of the parkway, encompassing 4,800 acres. The nonprofit held a town hall about the concerns along the parkway last week, which included county and elected officials. Diana joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the town hall last week, I believe the turnout was hundreds of people. What does that tell you?
You know, we had over 200 people there, and it was fabulous to see because we as a community really, really care about the parkway. And I think it was really evident in the passion, the questions. You know, we actually had to stop the questions at 8 p.m. So I think we could have probably gone on for a couple more hours just because of the number of questions.
Well, during that event, your foundation, the American River Parkway Foundation, you produced a video called Parkway in Peril. And essentially, you heard from parkway stewards who invest in maintaining the parkway about what they're experiencing firsthand. So we're going to take a listen to part of it. We're going to listen to Dan Hall and Leigh Rutledge.
When the fires occur, things don't just go back to normal the next year. It takes a lifetime in some cases to restore things.
Within 2 weeks' time, 9% of the parkway burned. 9%. With two and a half weeks, maybe. This is just last week. I mean, you know, 2 weeks ago, 9% of the parkway burned. You're kidding me. In 2 weeks, in June, what could happen by September?
You know, Diana, I mean, as we know, grass fires do happen along the parkway. What has changed in recent years?
I think it's a combination. You know, one, there are greater amounts of encampments. Two, we have an unprecedented dry drought year. Three, it's the management of the land, of the open space within the parkway. I mean, all three of those just combine to be a combustible situation. And that is one of the reasons that we actually created a fire safe council. So we are an approved fire safe council. We had our first meeting to really address how do we prevent this from moving forward. So we have all the entities who have infrastructure on the parkway, not only the utilities, but the water districts, the railroad, all of these individuals have a lot of concern when there is a fire on the parkway. So hopefully through the Fire Safe Council, we can really look at how do we mitigate some of the issues that are occurring on the parkway.
And I've interviewed you in the past about, you know, the issue with needles and trash along the parkway. You'd bring trash bags out and you'd have containers, safe storage containers for especially needles. I mean, especially during the summer months, people will live along the river, have access to water and cool off. So we're going to listen to another part of your video with a steward named Carl Haas.
We just run into sites that are just basically they are landfills. What I've seen out there is that the unhoused community there will find a spot and they'll just dump it there. All the debris that are out there potentially end up in our river. I mean, it contaminates our drinking water, our river, our delta, and then the ocean.
And we know that this issue is larger than the parkway. I mean, when it comes to the issue of homelessness, it's a crisis across California. Do you view it this way?
It is a crisis. It's a crisis across California, it's across multiple states. How do we address it? And I feel if we can begin to address it locally, hopefully we can be a model for other communities. We're so fortunate to have the parkway, But if we can't utilize the parkway for what we should be able to utilize it for, then what's the, you know, what is the point of having this great resource? So that is a concern of ours. And hopefully that the city and county are working together and being able to address homeless, illegal campers, whatever we want to describe them, and provide them the services they need so that others can utilize the parkway in a respectful manner.
Yeah. What are you hearing from visitors who go to the parkway when you're out there talking with people?
A lot of them don't, they'll only go to certain parts of the parkway, and that's not right. I mean, we want people to experience the entire parkway, all 23 miles, 4,800 acres, and not be afraid to go into areas of the parkway, because every section of the parkway is unique in its own, you know, from the red clay banks to the cottonwood groves, all the way up to, you know, fishing at Nimbus. So you want people to experience all of those features.
When you hosted that town hall, there were actually elected officials there from the county. How did it close? What did they say about this in terms of solutions, in terms of what they're doing to mitigate this and reduce this?
Yeah, for them, the county and the two supervisors that were there, Supervisor Cernan and Supervisor Desmond, are working with the two city council members and a 2x2 commission. They're looking at mental health services that can be provided. They're also looking at drug services that can be provided for those that are on the parkway, as well as others that are homeless. And really, the encouragement was for the community to speak up, to really be the voice of the parkway, to speak up and say, we demand change. And who better to do that than people that have the passion for a piece of land or want to restore their community?
Yeah, I mean, when you actually quantify how many people go to the parkway, I mean, I'm not surprised when you find out that it's, you know, several million people. But when you actually put a number on it and compare it to some national parks, I mean, it really is significant. So with that, I want to kind of close with solutions, because obviously that's the intention of the video, hosting just a very robust town hall turnout of a couple hundred people. And that was just in person. I mean, you had people there virtually as well. So there is a huge interest and investment in this, whether you live along the parkway, enjoy it, or your business along the parkway. So let's listen to parkway stewards Chris Balam and once again, Leigh Rutledge.
Almost 5 million people use the parkway every year. That's about the same as Yosemite. I think actually a little bit more people use the American River Parkway than go to Yosemite. Can you imagine somebody throwing a bottle in the Merced River at Yosemite? Your normal citizen would jump on that person and go crazy. But for some reason, people don't have a problem when they do it at the American River.
We have to call it what it is. It is not a homeless problem. It's a mental health and drug problem. And I totally agree with that statement. From what I've seen, I'm just one person out there helping, but from what I've seen, and that's where I would start. Help for those people, and hopefully things will start to improve.
And obviously, from your perspective as a nonprofit, you know, protecting the American River Parkway, we talked briefly about some solutions that could happen at the county level. But when we're talking about the issue of mental health and addiction and the in-house community, it's very complicated and nuanced. What do you think could happen in the immediacy? Because we've already had multiple grass fires along the parkway, and we're going to talk with the fire department about that in just a moment. But what can happen in the weeks and months ahead to help reduce this?
You know, from our perspective, it's really getting boots on the ground. As long as our volunteers continue to go out and remove debris, and we can only remove so much at a time. I mean, that's the reality. It's really working in conjunction with the fire department, with all the other stakeholders, to really address mitigating the fire danger out on the parkway. And I think between those two items, we can make forward progress, and reminding individuals, really providing that public education about what can occur on the parkway. You know, and as Keith and I have talked, you know, because it's their safety also out on the parkway.
Right.
And it's everyone's safety.
Do you work or talk with outreach organizations or nonprofits that are helping the issue or working to curb the issue of homelessness?
We do. We have a lot. We work with two of the navigators, and they actually work with our mile stewards, and they have attended our mile steward meetings on, you know, approaching homeless. What can we do? What, you know, what are solutions? We have actually started another program called our homeless abatement program in our trash abatement program, and that is actually providing additional bags to the homeless camps, so at least we can remove greater amounts of trash so it doesn't get into our waterways, that it doesn't pollute the soil, which then becomes a major public health issue for all of us, you know, living in Sacramento County. So we're trying to mitigate as much trash and toxic debris that is out there.
You know pretty much every nook and cranny and corner of the American River Parkway. You know, with that lens, what has surprised you most?
To me, it's the destruction of the parkway. You know, I understand people need a place to live, but when you're cutting trees down to make a home, that really, it just saddens me when you think how long it takes for certain trees to grow. That is one thing. And I the other part to me is just the lack of commitment for people to go to the lower reaches, because to me, the lower reaches is a fabulous area. Mm-hmm. And so that's that. It makes me sad that people are not utilizing this great resource.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're learning more about the concerns surrounding grass fires and contamination along the American River Parkway in Sacramento County. Joining us now is Captain Keith Wade with the City of Sacramento Fire Department. Captain Wade, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Vicki. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Captain Wade, you were part of the video that we were just playing excerpts of it from the American River Parkway Foundation. And what stuck out to me was that you said in your 20 years with the department, you've seen an uptick in incidents along the parkway.
Oh, for sure. And I like to say that in those 20 years, that uptick is significant. It's especially over the last several. We've really seen a lot of fire activity that's increased, and these fires are getting bigger. They're occurring with much more frequency, and our firefighters are really exhausted with the amount of, because we have a whole city that we're protecting as well, and then you throw this large parkway in the middle of our great city, and we're having to respond out to these areas for these fires. It's concerning for us.
You mentioned the incidents are challenging to respond to. Are there some specific examples that resonate with you?
Well, mostly the bigger ones. I can tell you every firefighter works in our department knows when you get that call that says American River Parkway near mile marker, whatever it is, 3 or 6. Last night we had an incident near mile marker 3 that I was monitoring. And they're difficult calls. They're difficult to access. We have to call for additional resources almost every time we move out into these areas because of where these fires are located, because they're occurring near and around homeless encampments where people are living. And a lot of times these people want to try to hide away from sight. So then they're getting into very difficult to reach areas. The vegetation's very thick in a lot of these areas. The trees are very big and old. And when they take this fire and this heat, a lot of times these trees unfortunately have to come down because they cause a safety hazard then for not just the firefighters who are in that area at that time fighting the fire. We call them widow makers. A big large branch can come down and strike a person in the head and kill them. We've seen that on big forest fires. It can occur out here in the parkway. But then that tree needs to unfortunately come down usually when they've suffered fire damage because of the people are going to be out there accessing the parkway for recreation. So we know that, and it's unfortunate anytime we have a fire out in these areas.
The parkway obviously is for everyone to enjoy. Do you think there needs to be more of an awareness and an investment from the general public to be proactive? Because usually when y'all are brought in, it's to respond to something dangerous happening.
Well yeah, there needs to be more of an more than just awareness. People need to be actively helping. And I don't know really what that looks like, because as a fire department, as an emergency response agency, it's not really our job to enforce a lot of things that are taking place. We're unfortunately coming out there in the most immediate need moment when a fire is occurring or a medical emergency is occurring. And it's really up to the whole public together in this fight to try to save this area and to help basically the people that are causing these fires to have them either understand or be removed from those areas. And I hate to say that because I don't want to say anyone needs to be forcibly removed, but when you're living out in these areas, when you're going to live, you're going to do activities that can start fires. It's why we have fire codes. It's why we have building codes. It's why we have cooking codes for restaurants. Because when you do these activities, there's a safety item with them. We know historically people can be injured or killed when they're doing anything that can spark a fire. So now you throw this out into a vegetation area, a wildland area, where there's combustibles. All those things that are out there can burn. You're going to have what we are all experiencing, which are these large scale fires.
And I'm going to kind of end with asking both of you this. Diana, I'll start with you. What can individuals keep in mind on the front end, you know, just when they go to the parkway, just to help out in any way that they can, as simple as it could be?
One, I mean, reach out if you are interested in volunteering. And two, just be aware of your surroundings. I mean, be fire cognizant of what's around you. And the other thing is also enjoy when you're out there and enjoy the nature and the beauty that we have so close, but to definitely be aware of what's around you.
Captain Wade.
Yeah, I think Diana said it best right there. To be aware of what's around you. I want to urge everyone, as soon as they see something that appears to be an unsafe type of activity, to please reach out, call 911. Or you know, local law enforcement, be involved in the management of the parkway so that it's here for future generations to enjoy and to remain safe for everybody.
Captain Wade and Diana, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
And that is Captain Keith Wade with the City of Sacramento Fire Department and Diana Poggetto with the American River Parkway Foundation. Up next, a local journalist joins us with his latest investigation into the connection between wildfires, PG&E, and its influence on state politics as California's wildfires continue to worsen. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We do have some breaking news to pass along this hour. NPR is reporting that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has announced he is resigning following a report by the New York Attorney General that concluded he sexually harassed 11 women. Cuomo will resign in 14 days. He was elected governor in 2010 and was serving his third term. NPR, of course, will have the latest at the top of the hour following Insight. All right. PG&E is California's largest utility company. Since 2015, 5 of the 10 most destructive wildfires in the state have been linked to PG&E equipment. As I speak, PG&E is being investigated for its role in the Dixie Fire, which is currently the second largest wildfire in state history, and containment is still weeks away. A local journalist has been investigating PG&E's connection to wildfires and influence on state politics for the past 3 years, beginning with the 2018 Camp Fire. I was in court last summer when PG&E pled guilty to killing 84 people for failing to maintain nearly century-old equipment that caused the deadliest wildfire in state history. It is the largest corporate-caused homicide in the country. At that time, PG&E promised to never again put profits ahead of safety. ABC 10 journalist Brandon Ridderman has been investigating if those promises made were kept. His reporting project is called Fire, Power, Money and recently was nominated for a Peabody Award. His third season premieres tonight, and Brandon joins us with a preview. Brandon, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Vicki. Thanks for having me.
Well, Brandon, this is the third season investigating PG&E. You've been knee-deep in this for years, nearly 3 years since the Camp Fire, digging into this. So let's just take a big step back. How do you explain your reporting project to someone with little to no knowledge of what fire, power, money is?
So thanks for the question, Vicki. The When we started out on this, I actually wasn't all that interested in the PG&E angle of the campfire. When I was asked to look into PG&E, the first thing I wanted to see was, why did 85 people die in this fire? A month after the fire, we produced a special called Escaping Paradise that looked at problems with the evacuation. But after that, we felt like there was more that needed to be done. So we started gathering interviews and exploring PG&E and how it's regulated. And there was this surreal moment in about an hour and a half long interview with a fire victim's lawyer, where he just sort of casually mentioned in passing that PG&E had been convicted of 6 federal felonies. And two or three questions later in the interview, I had to stop him and go, hold on, wait, did you say felonies? And from there, I learned about Sam Bruno and began sort of piecing together the makings of the first season of Firepower Money. Because I quickly realized if they'd been convicted of felonies in 2016 and they were still donating to California politicians, the old politics reporter in me said, aha, a felon donating to politicians. You know, if it was a human felon, that would be scandalous and they'd be giving the money back and all that. Where's that attitude for PG&E? And I looked into it and it turned out that not only did Governor Newsom benefit from more than $200,000 of PG&E political money, 8 out of 10 lawmakers, both in the congressional delegation for California and in the state legislature, which passed laws that the governor advanced to bail PG&E out, had received PG&E contributions while they were a convicted felon on probation serving, you know, their sentence. And we emailed all of them, and very few responded. A handful did and donated away the money. And when we finally managed to be able to confront Governor Newsom about this, which was pre-pandemic, he called it a strange question. And I think that gets at the heart of this, is we have not reckoned as a society with corporate crime. The law treats corporations as people, but it is a fiction. They are convicted of felonies, much like you or I would be, but unlike you or I, you cannot put handcuffs on them. So they were not given the 90 years that the judge, as you know, said they deserved in the campfire crimes. These were not accidents. This was systematic cutting of spending on safety. As the judge overseeing their probation puts it, they robbed safety budgets to enhance the bottom line and pay bigger profits to shareholders. The suggestion from the experts I'm talking to, and certainly the outcomes on the ground with PG&E being suspected of causing large fires every year since the campfire, would suggest that things haven't changed.
You know, given that this is your third year, I mean, really just practically squarely focused on this investigation, this is the third season of Firepower Money. What motivates you to stick with this? And I ask this as someone, both you and I covered the campfire in Paradise, and I went to Paradise just a couple weeks ago, and there are so many people that are still rebuilding, and for some still waiting for their settlements from PG&E.
Yeah, I would say my motivations here are twofold. One is that experience you described of being up in the campfire. I've covered Western wildfires for 16 years, and there just simply isn't anything I've seen that compares with it. I mean, we had the Carr Fire earlier in 2018 with the fire tornado, which was its own wild episode. But there was no, you know, suggestion of criminal wrongdoing by anyone in that fire. To have been in Paradise and witness the total destruction of a fairly dense town for a foothills community, watching the main street burn and then seeing, you know, massive neighborhoods 360 degrees all alight at the same time, witnessing all of that and having to, frankly, work fairly hard myself to escape with my own life. You know, I have a lot of empathy for what people went through who survived. And I've also spent a lot of nights thinking about what it was like for the 85 people who passed. And I've spent hours and hours and hours talking to their families and the family members of people who have died in fires blamed on PG&E since. And they deserve better than this. If this story gets covered as a energy story and a business story more often than it gets covered as a crime story. And I think that in order to realize change, that has to change. And that's something that I think is, you know, an area where our industry could do a lot better. But it's tough. It's complicated and deliberately so.
Did you expect the trajectory of your reporting to take you down this road?
Not at all. Not at all. Like most people, when you hear broken equipment on a power line, you think, oh my goodness, accident. You know, that is the first presumption. And like I told you, you know, my first instinct was, well, let's just find out why so many people died, you know? But then you take a step back and you look at the causes and conditions and why did this hook break? Well, the hook broke because they stopped rigorously inspecting their equipment and left a 100-year-old part that they knew was grinding away because they had addressed it before, but not changed out the hook. They knew, but didn't track this problem. And that isn't necessarily a failing of the guys who and gals who climbed the towers to go up and have a look at these things. The system that PG&E has made does not track the equipment. I mean, the prosecutor said they didn't have records of what was done. You know, they have records that they went by and looked, but they didn't keep detailed records of what was done to these parts. And you know, they also uncovered evidence that the company was paying out bonuses for supervisors who managed to squeeze the maintenance budgets. So this is a boardroom problem and an executive, a C-suite problem. But the C-suite's been a revolving door, as you know.
Right. And since your last investigation in that time, you know, PG&E pled guilty to killing 84 people. A fire victims trust was created. So this latest season that's going to be premiering tonight on ABC 10, you're focusing squarely on the governor. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, so look, the thing is, we've investigated PG&E for years. And at some point you look at them and you see, you know, you are a repeat felon. You know, giving the same answers after your subsequent felonies. And you have to wonder, okay, you're a regulated industry, right? And that's because PG&E is a legal monopoly, okay? PG&E owns its power lines. It does not own the right to operate as a monopoly business. And that's sort of the regulation bargain. They call it the compact. We're supposed to be entitled to safe, reliable service at just and reasonable rates out of that compact. Does anyone think any of that is happening? I think it's hard to make a case that it is. And that's why we investigated how it's being regulated and what is being done as the policy response. And what you'll see this week on ABC 10, when our pieces air in our 6:30 newscast is the policy response was to protect PG&E. I mean, that was the core of it. There are sweeteners in there. There's certainly responsibility to spend some money on safety, money that a federal judge handling their probation says they should have been spending all along. You know, you can go down the list, but the core of it was to prop up the credit rating of PG&E. And it was so at the core of the plan that that's how the victims are supposed to get paid. They were turned into shareholders. So the people who were hurt the most by PG&E are now almost 25% owners of PG&E, and it's not worth nearly as much money, those shares of stock, as the victims were promised in bankruptcy court.
Yeah, right. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with ABC 10 journalist Brandon Ritteman about his latest investigation called Fire, Power, Money, looking into PG&E and connections with state politics. I mean, ultimately, when you get to the heart of it, this affects people. This affects human beings. So ultimately, how does this impact wildfire victims?
The outcomes are so bad. To just leave aside the moment for the question of the 85 plus people who have lost their lives as a result of the campfire. You're talking about tens of thousands of people displaced. You know, it's a mass displacement. If you go up to Paradise and have a look, there is very little standing. And the vast majority of them, thankfully, somehow survived. But most of those people are gone. They're not going back home. Who wants to wait for 3 or 4 years to rebuild the house? Most of them, if they had insurance money, took that money and built somewhere else or bought somewhere else. And the handful of people that are trying to really eke it out, among them, you will find people who managed to rebuild, but you will also find people camping on their own land where their houses used to stand. And, you know, we've talked to some of them. We've heard stories like, I had a mobile home and the insurance didn't pay out nearly enough to build a stick-built home. And the mobile home parks aren't open again. But I want to be here. I want to stay in paradise. So here I am. Those people are owed restitution money. This was 85 felonies. 85 felonies. And these are crime victims. They should be getting that money, and they're not. And the reason that they're not is because the bankruptcy plan, which was brokered and approved by Governor Gavin Newsom, prioritized PG&E's exit from bankruptcy and not wiping out PG&E's past shareholders, which does happen in some bankruptcies, over the fortunes of the victims. Full stop. And we'll be talking about that on tomorrow night's episode. But it's one of many topics to get into with this.
This is your third season. What kind of criticism or response have you received with your investigations?
Particularly with the Dixie Fire, I've been hearing from folks up there who are flabbergasted that PG&E is still in a position of authority. They're horrified. They're watching their homes be threatened and destroyed in some cases. They're watching, there are people who don't live up there who have lifelong memories, you know, growing up, going to those forests. And they're deeply appreciative to see a light shone on these issues because it is so deep and so systemic. We have heard some criticism. The timing is what it is with the recall election coming up. That doesn't motivate me. I was in the campfire and I've been working on this nearly full time since. But, you know, those who may not be familiar with our investigation maybe don't know that. But, you know, that's just the reality of it. We'd actually intended to get this out in May of this year, but we kept finding more things. And those things take time to investigate. We're not going to air until we're ready. So here we are.
Yeah, and really the goal of investigative work is to highlight problems, but also point towards solutions. What can happen to remedy what happened? What can be done to prevent this from happening again? You know, because as we mentioned, PG&E is California's largest utility company.
America's largest, actually. One in 20 Americans gets their power from this company. I've talked to a lot of experts who argue that's too big. You need to break it up. There are people who will argue it needs to be taken over. None of those things are easy. They're not impossible. And I'm not here to advocate for any one of those. But what I will advocate for, happily, is accountability. When are we as a society going to acknowledge the value of the human lives and the criminal ending of those lives? You know, this is as simple as, you know, if you reward a kid's bad behavior, you know, in some respects, what would you expect to keep happening? If the response from our government is accommodation in the wake of criminal activity, I think that's a problem. So what's the solution? Let's start with not that. And then maybe get some smart people in a room to figure out what it looks like. The company, by the way, will say they are breaking themselves up. We're a new company. You know, they keep promising change, and they, you know, go back to San Bruno. They've been promising change. They'll say they're breaking themselves up. They have a regionalization process that's winding through the CPUC, which is all well and good to change the way that you're managing internally. But, you know, A, proof's in the pudding. So let's see how things go. But B, it's all going to trade under ticker symbol PCG on Wall Street. You know what I mean? And all you need to do is look back to 2017, the last year they paid a dividend, and that's really their main product. It's not electricity. It was a $1 billion dividend they shipped to Wall Street that year. It was a record. And then right after they shipped the last quarterly dividend, Wine Country fires and elsewhere around Northern California. And every year since, the crisis continues.
You know, you mentioned the timeliness of all of this. Obviously, we're approaching a recall election next month, and these are some, you know, pretty bold. This is pretty bold reporting that is really squarely focused on the governor. I understand that, you know, he didn't sit down with you and give you an interview. Did his office give you any response to this investigation that's premiering tonight?
They did. We emailed a list of 18 specific questions and a summary of our findings to the governor's office. All 18 questions, including some that were asked by victims in our reporting, were ignored. But we were sent a statement along with some other suggested folks that we talked to. And the statement says, no governor in California history has done more to hold PG&E accountable and force the company to make fundamental change. That's what it leads off with, which comparisons to other governors are really somewhat irrelevant. The company did not commit the felony killing of 84 people under any other governor. There was the San Bruno explosion in 2010. So under Governor Brown, they were convicted of felonies, but those weren't homicide felonies. It was an obstruction of justice charge and five violations of the Federal Gas Pipeline Act. So certainly there'd be some fair questions or comparisons, I suppose, in some respects, because it was a deadly tragedy, but certainly not when it comes to the criminality that underlies it, or at least the convictions. That was an interesting way to begin the statement from my perch.
Brandon, thank you for sharing your investigation.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Brandon Ritteman is a journalist with ABC 10. He's talking with us about his reporting project, Fire, Power, Money. It is a years-long investigation on PG&E, its connection to some of the deadliest and most destructive wildfires in California history, and the utility company's influence on state politics. The latest three-part series premieres tonight on ABC 10. Still ahead, Donna Appadoni joins us with her latest Cap Radio Read segment, Outdoors, with James Beard award-winning author and chef Hank Shaw. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Well, we are lucky to have a vibrant farm-to-fork scene in our backyard. I mean, the ease of just being connected with our food, really at our fingertips, and, you know, if we make the effort. But we're going to introduce you to someone who takes the process full circle. I mean, encouraging a full experience from hunting, foraging, angling for what we want to eat. Hank Shaw is the founder of the website Hunter Angler Gardener Cook, which received the prestigious James Beard distinction. Based in Sacramento, Hank's focus is wild foods, and he hasn't bought meat or fish more than a handful of times since 2005. So nothing packaged, nothing in a box, nothing wrapped in plastic. Donna Appadoni joins us with her latest Cap Radio Read segment, an interview with James Beard award-winning author and chef Hank Shaw. Donna, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Vicki. Nice to be here. And what fun we had, Hank Shaw and I. We had a great time talking, and the podcast is evidence of that. We laughed a lot.
Oh, I loved listening to the podcast. It's nearly an hour. It goes by so fast, and he's just such a laid-back guy, and I could just tell you were having a lot of fun with it. And I learned a lot about you, too, growing up.
Yeah, there's a lot in there, isn't there?
Well, before we get to the culinary career of Hank Shaw, you know, just a bit of a backstory. He was a veteran political journalist with local ties, right?
Yeah, he came to town. He told me to cover Governor Schwarzenegger, worked as a political reporter for 15, 16 years, and just never left. It's that kind of community. People stick around.
Yeah.
And he told a great story in the interview about how he almost got kicked off the floor at the Capitol because of his clothing. So that alone is worth listening to.
Yeah, then the three-piece suit that he was talking about.
Windsor knot. Yeah.
I love how he just views the experience of food, you know, from hunting and gathering to the finished product. I mean, I was watching a video with him and he said, it allows me to create a dish that is a memory. That's such a poignant way to view food and the experience of food.
It's a memory for him, and it's also what's coming up for him. He is so start to finish. Just what you said in the opener, that since 2005, he hasn't bought anything packaged. Think about that for a minute. Since 2005, he has been hunting and foraging and gathering everything that he eats. I can't even come close to that. A lot of people can't. So he is creating his memories, but he's also creating something that he anticipates, something that he looks forward to on his next trip out.
Well, you interviewed Hank for his fifth book, Hook, Line, and Supper. We're going to hear some excerpts from your interview. What stands out to you about his book?
I think the thing that stood out to me most is that we have a good, solid, back to the land thing going on in our community. You know, in the last couple of years, I've wondered, why aren't people farming again in their own backyards? Why aren't they fishing? Why aren't they hunting? And it has been happening and building all along, to the extent which I didn't realize until I talked with Hank. But it's a nice, strong community of people who are out there doing this work. It's sort of a political thing in that it serves the environment as much as it serves the health of the person.
What was one of the first things you guys chatted about?
Well, I had to admit that I know nothing about fishing, even though I grew up around a lot of people who fish. I had people in my family on the eastern shore of Florida and in the Great Lakes region and along the Chesapeake Bay, people who were anglers, people who really knew what they were doing, and I never picked up on any of it. So I had to start by asking Hank what I thought was an obvious question. What would a non-fisher person like me find attractive about this sport?
I think the attraction for a non-angler to become an angler is to put yourself in interesting places and to create it's a skill. It is 100% a skill. Even rock fishing, which if those of you listening to this are familiar with rock fishing, it's not exactly the most challenging form of fishing that you can do, but nor is it as easy as people think it is. And so you need to develop a sense of touch. You need to develop a sense of kind of an out-of-bodiness that really very few other pursuits require, because you can't see what's going on where your hook is. It's all sensory. It's all touch and kind of intuition. And like, I, for example, just yesterday I was fishing for rockfish near the Farallons. And when you're bouncing your weight on the bottom, I can tell whether it's sand, mud, metal, or rock, depending on how it feels. And I can tell that's a rockfish. I can tell that's a lingcod, because you get this kind of extrasensory perception that radiates from the hook to the terminal tackle, all the way up the line to the reel, to where your fingers and hands are, that there is this kind of weird sense that you get that, like, you don't get in a great many other things, because most of us are purely visual or auditory creatures. And, you know, to really develop that sense of touch. And I mean, let's just say it. I mean, it is absolutely thrilling to reel in a fish. It just is. You know, the hashtag on Instagram and everything is the tug is the drug, man. And when you've got a big old fish on the other end of the line, 100% that's thrilling.
Thrilling. That was the word that got me. Thrilling. How often can you say that your dinner was thrilling? But that's the sense that Hank and other people get when they start with fishing and end up with fish in their mouths.
Yeah. Hey, I'm right there with you, Donna. I'm not, I don't fish, and I wouldn't know where to start either. And so I loved listening to him and kind of guide novices or just people who are just interested in fishing along the way.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And of course, that's what I needed to know next. When I found out that it was going to be thrilling, I needed to know where to start.
That's a great question, and it's the great answer is that this is the beauty of fishing. You can literally go online and buy a one-day license from Fish and Wildlife and book a spot on a party boat, which, I mean, we were on the Seawolf yesterday out of Emeryville, and you can book a spot on a party boat knowing nothing. Call, you know, when you go there, tell the Met deckhands, hey, I'm super new, I need some help here. And they do an instruction before every day you do the spiel, right? So like, okay, welcome to Seawolf. We're gonna be rock fishing today. And they're gonna give you like a quick tutorial. And then you can come up to them afterwards and say, okay, this is my first time or whatever, whatever. And everyone is overjoyed to welcome a new angler to the fold, really.
They don't laugh at you because you're new.
No, no. I mean, the only dumb question is the one you ask three times. You get two.
I like that.
Well, thank goodness we get two dumb questions, right? And I think that's where we get to know Hank a little bit better. That's where we get to know that he wants a healthy experience. He wants interesting food. He wants us to enjoy it, but he also really wants us to understand it and absorb it.
I kind of do love it all. Like as soon as we get off this podcast, I'm going to be breaking down some of the fish from yesterday. And I really enjoy that. I think it's kind of like opening up a present where you've got your animal, whether it's hunting or fishing or whatever. And then as you break it into whatever pieces or whatever process you're going through, what's going through your mind is all the different ways that you might be able to cook it and serve it. And like, oh, this is really special, or this one's especially fatty. I'm going to flash freeze it and cook it as, or eat it raw. Or it becomes this, it goes from the fishing aspect of it to the cooking aspect of it. And it's that transformation that really is exciting because it gets your brain moving in the sense that, this one's really perfect. I'm going to actually put this one on the grill, or this one's a little bit damaged. This one's going to become fish cakes. And it's just a nice kind of a Zen part to it. Now, I understand that because I've done it, you know, pretty much continuously since I was a teenager, it's not hard. And I mean, I give full instructions in the book on how to fillet all kinds of fish in there if that's what you want to learn. But I think it's also important to emphasize with Hook, Line, and Supper is not an angler specific book. It's really a consumer specific book that provides lots of information for anglers as well.
And what I love is that it's just more than a cookbook, Donna.
Oh, it's so much more than a cookbook. But he does have some recipes in there, as well as how to hold the fish and how to catch the fish and transport the fish. But there are some recipes in there. And of course, I needed his advice there, too.
I would start with the searing technique, because this is a technique that everybody loves it. It's almost universal in terms of the different kinds of fish you can use with it. And it is something that gives you great pleasure when you pull it off, because you may not get it the first time, but it's a thing to strive for that isn't so complicated that it's going to take you, you know, months to do. And the simple version of that is this. So you have a piece of fish, whether it has a skin on or skin off. And the goal is to cook it the way you'd get it in a restaurant, which is to say an incredibly beautiful sear on either the skin or the side that the skin used to be on. And then it's not overcooked somehow. So the answer to that is that you really, unless it's very thick, the answer to that is to sear it hard on one side, tip the pan while it's searing, and baste the exposed side with the hot oil or hot butter or hot fat. And that trick is so indispensable for cooking fish and seafood that I foresee myself doing this over and over and over again on demos this entire year, because that's the bedrock skill. Like for my Duck Duck Goose book, I was teaching people how to cook duck breast properly. And I think this is the equivalent of that. And once you have that one skill, it will set you free, because let's face it, most fish recipes, and that's why you're right. And you're correct in identifying that this is not a recipe book. This is a book of techniques and structure and master recipes. Once you have that technique of searing fish, most fish so-called recipes is that perfectly seared fish with a bunch of nice things to eat alongside it. And those nice things to eat are up to you.
Well, he really has a knack also for titles of books.
Oh, he really does. Aren't they wonderful? This one is called Hook, Lion, and Supper. He had Duck, Duck, Goose, and Buck, Buck, Moose, and Pheasant, Quail, Cottontail. He's just so clever that way. As you heard, his passion is there, and his passion is contagious. And it really, listen, if I get hungry just reading the book and listening to him, imagine what's going to happen when I actually start cooking.
Donna, thanks for spending some time with us this morning.
Nice to be with you.
Donna Appadoni chatting with us about her latest Cap Radio Read segment, an interview with James Beard award-winning author and chef Hank Shaw. Hank's new book, Hook, Line, and Supper, is available now, and you can listen to Donna's nearly hour-long interview. It's a lot of fun on Cap Radio Reads podcast. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. Following Insight, NPR will have more on breaking news. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced he is resigning following a report by the New York Attorney General that concluded he sexually harassed 11 women. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.